Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 21st of May 2017. My name's TRP Watson, and this week I'm joined by Phil from the West End Whingers, Gareth James. We're now going to talk about Angels in America at the National Theatre. It's being done in the Littleton Theatre. This is Tony Kushner's 1991 play. It's set into two parts, Millennium Approaches and Perestroika, and really covers the years from 1985 through to 1986, with the devastation and the toll that AIDS was beginning to take, and several characters who contract the disease. We also have a brief coda in the early 90s where we see what has happened to some of the characters that we remember. The characters we have in the play are Lewis Ironson, who is gay and Jewish, and he discovers that his partner, his lover, Prior Walter, which is a very odd name and acknowledged, there are lots of odd names in this place. Prior Walter, he has AIDS and deserts him. He can't cope with the idea of Prior Walter being ill, and he can't cope with the guilt of not caring enough and not being prepared to look after Prior. He starts a relationship with a young man called Joe Pitt, who is a Mormon and who is an upwardly mobile judicial clerk. These are the lawyers who write decisions for judges or write up the decisions of judges. They're not really supposed to write them, but in many cases they do write them up. And Joe Pitt has fallen in with a very famous McCarthyist lawyer called Roy Cohn. And Roy Cohn is a real character, but I think we're supposed to think that he's, because Roy Cohn, by the time this was written, was dead, they can say what they like about him. So it's sort of a fantasy version of Roy Cohn. And Joe is closetly homosexual and has an unhappy marriage with his wife Harper. And Harper is addicted to pills and takes far too many of them and goes off on sort of adventures of the mind. And we actually see her sometimes hallucinating things, like a travel agent offering her round-the-world travel, or she goes to the South Pole, or she bumps into this rather strange drag queen called Prior Walter at one point. So there's some very strange things that go on. And as Prior Walter's disease really takes force, as he has, you know, periods of very bad sickness and remission, he also suffers kind of visions. And one of his visions is the coming of an angel, marking him out as the great prophet of the age. And that's where we get the angels from in America, where we have the angel who is the angel that represents the continent of America, or at least the continent of North America, is coming to visit, and coming to visit Prior and to make him the angel's prophet. That's the general idea in the play, but this is the idea that he has. Back to Roy Cohn, who is in denial. He convinces his doctor to say that he's got liver cancer, and really we track the sicknesses of these two characters who have AIDS, Roy Cohn and Prior Walter, through their relationships with Lewis and Joe and Harper. We also get Joe's mother, Mrs. Pitt, who, discovering that her son and Harper are thinking of divorcing, sells up her house in Utah and comes to New York to find them. And by accident, she becomes a friend of Prior Walter. We get the angel, who is this rather strange beast, who is dragged around the stage on, it almost looks as if they can't fly, on, and is dragged around the stage on ungainly wings and picked up by other people in this particular production. The other major character is a young former drag queen, now a nurse. His name is Belize. He is a black man, and he is a former lover of Prior Walter, but he is the person who is prepared to stick by Prior Walter and to look after everybody, and he is also a nurse, to Roy Cohn in the later stages. So that's really the setup. This is the way Tony Kushner gets to talk about the different relationships that people have and the sort of tracks the history of AIDS in America in the mid-80s and also goes back a little bit into history. We do have the idea of Roy Cohn being haunted by Ethel Rosenberg and his great crime, according to this play and historically something he did, was that he was the person who made sure that Ethel Rosenberg got electrocuted, although the jury at her trial for treason recommended mercy in her case. They didn't recommend it for her husband, of course. These are the Rosenbergs. These were big spy ring in the 50s. This production is directed by Marion Elliott with a design by Ian McNeil, of which more later. It stars Nathan Lane as Roy Cohn, Amanda Lawrence as the Angel, Nathan Stewart Jarrett as Belize, Russell Tovey as Joe Pitt, Andrew Garfield as Prior Walter, Denise Goff as Harper Pitt, and James McArdle as Lewis Ironson, and Susan Brand plays Mrs. Pitt. I have to say, for me, there was a major problem with this play, certainly the first part of this play. These plays are very long, and I think you worked out before, over 8 hours, all told, they're currently running at. Now, we both saw previews, so it might change. But one of the things I objected to, particularly in this play, and upset me a lot, was the set. I've never been upset. I've been going to the theatre over 30 years. I've never been quite so upset by a set in my life. So I'm not sure what's going on. But the first two-thirds of the first part of the play were all done on this thin platform, which has three revolves, and one's for Roy Cohn's life, one's for Harper Pitt, and one's for Prior Walter. And they're just these little revolves that go across the stage, and they're flat, and they're boring, and they're tawdry, and I couldn't believe that I was watching this at the National Theatre. I thought it was an utter, utter disgrace, I'm sorry to say. It's a possibility that they fixed it, because when I saw part two a week later, although the revolves were still in evidence right at the back of the stage, they were actually, when they wanted to make scene changes, they seemed to have some kind of temporary structure that they were getting the puppeteers for the Angel to drag on. And I wondered if that was a new thing, and that might have explained some of the problems that they had at in the second half. Now, I'll talk more later, but have you got initial thoughts on this production?
I'm going to come in with you about the sets to get that out of the way from my part. I was quite shocked by the sets in the part one. The problem is the Littleton is a massive stage, and for a production like this, which is a sort of an epic, it's thrusting everything right to the very front of the stage for the most part, and also keeping the actors to little pockets of the stage. So because I was sitting quite near the front, which is, you know, it's the cheap seat, so fair enough, but looking like a tennis match on one side of the stage, then the other side, all the middle, and it wasn't utilising the whole stage. The second part, Perestroika, is visually much, much better because they are using the whole stage. I thought the same as you, that maybe they've made a sudden decision to ditch those hideous sets. But because there are bigger sets in the second, which are sort of wheeled on, that may be how it's done. I don't know. I'd be interested to know people who'd seen part two and see, find out if that has been got rid of. But it was seemed to me a huge mistake. Despite that, and given that I saw the first preview of part one and the first preview of part two, with, if you're including delays and extended intervals, 8 hours and 25 minutes. I mean, we came out of the end of part two at 12:45, and that's from a 7 o'clock start. That is punishing. But despite that, and because the plays are just so well written, I think, and also very, very funny throughout, I was tremendously entertained. I think they definitely need to cut it, because I just think, it just in practical terms of people getting home afterwards, people were having to leave before the last act of part two when I saw it. You'd see people getting on their apps doing trains, see when the last train was. And it's all very well to do that, a preview, an early preview. You can understand things go wrong, and I'm sure they'll be cut. But apparently Tony Kushner has added to the original plays. He's written new stuff for it, which I think, you know, they're long enough and they should have done a lot more cutting before they even put it on the stage. It's quite absurd. There was quite a bit could have been cut. Having said that, I thought it was tremendously entertaining. The performances in it are across the board fantastic. Nathan Lane is brilliant as Roy Cohn. Roy Cohn was also one of the McCarthy attorneys and was an early attorney for Donald Trump. So, he is a complete shyster. He does it very funny. He's also, he does it very well. He's also very, very funny. Funny and nasty at the same time. Great performances all round from everybody else. Russell Tovey, Denise Goff, James McArdle. James McArdle in the first act has a wonderful scene with Nathan Stewart Jarrett, the nurse. Nathan Stewart Jarrett is just reacting to this stream of consciousness from James McArdle. And James McArdle's delivery made it seem as though he was thinking about what he was saying and was thinking up on the spot. It came out as a stream of consciousness and was brilliantly done and also very funny. I mean, there are so many ideas in this that we could actually go on probably for 8 hours talking about it, but we won't, will we? But for me, the performance of the night was Andrew Garfield as Prior Walter, the dying ex-drag queen. He's stupendous throughout. And bear in mind, these performances we saw, or I saw, were at the first preview of each part. So really, in terms of the performances, they were there, I think. And they'll probably no doubt get even better. I also want to mention, apart from Nathan Stewart Jarrett, who's very, very good as the nurse, and particularly in the second part where he's very funny, Susan Brown, playing a series of roles, including the Mormon mother, was excellent, even when she has to do sort of gender-blind roles. Normally that kind of thing annoys me, but it worked here. And especially Amanda Lawrence, who's a favourite of mine, she plays various things like an old lady, a hospital nurse, and the angel, which she does fantastically. I mean, they flesh out quite a lot of character in smallish roles or a series of small roles. It's actually quite a small cast for such a massive, you know, the other people are just sort of really to operate the angel's wings and change the furniture occasionally. I assume some of them are doubling up as understudies as well, I don't know. God knows, I wouldn't want to be an understudy on this. So, yeah, I think it really is worth seeing if you can get a ticket for it. But bear in mind the running time, because it is quite indulgent, I think, in that. But I assume cutting will be done. I did see the original national production in 1992. I assume I saw both parts. I remember seeing both parts in the Cottesloe, which is not the most comfortable of theatres, and I survived that. It's even though I was in the cheap £15 seats at the front, which are pretty uncomfortable, I was held throughout. And I think held because there's so much going on, there's so much to think about, and it's just entertaining because it's funny. So it worked for me, despite all the flaws.
I saw this back in 2007, which was some kind of anniversary. I think, what would that be, the 15th anniversary of the play. I saw that done by Headlong at the Lyric Hammersmith. It featured Kirsty Bushell and Joseph Fewings and Greg Hicks and Mark Emmertson. I was very impressed by that, and I wasn't anything like as impressed by this. And it really was that darn set that really, I mean, I can't believe I was so upset by it. I was over on one side, so it meant I kind of missed out on quite a lot. I was on the Roy Cohn side rather than on the Prior Walter side, so I missed quite a lot of Andrew Garfield's, any subtleties of Andrew Garfield's performance. Although, of course, Prior Walter, there is not an awful lot of subtlety expected from him. He is rather loud a lot of the time. So I found it rather subdued and not all that impressive. And the person who disappointed me the most was Denise Goff, because I remember how impressed I was by Kirsty Bushell in the same role 10 years ago, and I just, you know, she's a very impressive actress, and people have been raving about her, and I was expecting great things of her, and I didn't get it. And I think that's part of the problem I had with this play, that you've got a Hollywood star, you've got in Andrew Garfield, you've got a Broadway star with Nathan Lane, you've got great favourites like Amanda Lawrence and, of course, Denise Goff, and you've got other people like James McArdle and Nathan Stewart Jarrett to Susan Brown, who are, you know, very, very good actors and very solid. But I was so disappointed in this. I just felt it's not the sum of anything like the sum of its parts. This should be blowing me away, and it isn't. And I do think it is the set. I think it's badly conceived. There's a whole thing which isn't used until the edge of the second half, and you just think, what is this structure, this scaffold, this is hovering over the set that they're not using. They're not using it in the first half. They're not using it, and they barely use it in the second half. And, you know, I was so angry with the set, I couldn't see past it. It's terrifying.
I do know what you mean about that metalwork, because you do spend quite a lot of time wondering, what is that for? And then when it's used in part two, it's kind of, is that it, really? I think also you're saying about them being sort of stuck in part one on various parts. You always got the bed on one side. In part two, they don't do that. When they appear in the beds, they keep switching sides. They're moving them around. And I think they may have made some serious decisions in the 2 weeks of previews that had been going on and started reconceiving part two, which may explain why the night we saw the first preview of part two, it began 15 minutes late and there were longer intervals, because maybe they weren't that well rehearsed. And there were a few, you know, little slips of timing with stagehands appearing with lights on them at various points, which I think could be explained by perhaps some sudden re-blocking. I don't know. We'll find out, no doubt, in time when we hear of other people who've been to see it. But despite those things and despite the set, I still found it incredibly entertaining. And there was a lot to think about it. I think towards the end of part two, the big sort of climactic heaven scene, I was kind of losing it a bit. I was up there talking about an awful lot of different things, and I was just getting a bit overloaded with it all. I think there's almost too much going on in it.
Yeah, and also there's a sense of when you get something which is written slightly after the events, you get that idea of them predicting the correct events, which I noticed happened once or twice, which I found annoying. And the other thing, I mean, going back to the part one where I was upset for about two-thirds of the play while they were using the awful Revolve set, I kept thinking, I should not be in a situation where the best person on stage at the moment is Susan Brown. And it shocked me to think that. I mean, she is very good, and you can't deny that she is excellent in this, and
she's
the equal of all the others. But I would have liked to have been more impressed by Nathan Lane and by Andrew Garfield. In fact, what I would like to have been is blown away by them, and I wasn't, certainly not in the first part. I think in the second part, because they've probably restaged it slightly, we get a much more fluid performance. We get much more moving around. They're much more moving around the stage, even though they're bedbound often. But they do come alive a lot more. I didn't think it really came alive in the first part. I think that narrowness of set gave us a narrowness of action. But, you know, I just sound obsessional, and they've probably cut the set now, so it's completely pointless to be talking about it.
Also, the one thing that I didn't like about it, and it's a very difficult play, I think, when you've seen so much that Andrew Garfield's prior alter comes to the front and addresses the audience. And I found that too much like something from an American play, which is, of course, telling us as an audience how fabulous we all are. I'm sorry, I wanted to vomit at that point. It really annoyed me. And I just thought it spoiled it. I thought that it needed a better ending. It kind of has this sort of uplifting kind of thing when a lot of what we watched has been quite grim, despite the humour. I can see why they did it, but it didn't work for me. It just felt a bit cheesy.
We're now going to talk about While We're Here by Barney Norris. This is at the Bush Theatre's new studio space. It's actually, I think, about the same size as the old Bush Theatre in terms of area, and certainly in terms of the number of people they can get into the audience. This is the old Bush Theatre when it was up above the pub rather than in the old library, which they've extensively renovated and created this studio space. Barney Norris had a couple of rather interesting plays. He works with the director Alice Hamilton on his plays, and they tend to be known as Up in Arms, as the theatre company they run together. And he's had a couple of rather successful plays in the last couple of years. Visitors, which I think went from the Arcola into the West End for a brief time, but also Eventide, which was at the Arcola, I think, last year. So this play is in that similar kind of area. He seems to concentrate quite a lot on, well, Hampshire, really. We have a play set in the New Forest. This play is set around Portsmouth, so I think we're in Emsworth or Havant. It's only I know these places because I used to go to school near there. So there's quite a lot of places I'm familiar with the names in this particular play. Gareth, tell me more about this play and what you thought of it.
It's his third play I've seen, because I saw both The Visitors, which was a play about dementia, and Eventide, which was a play really about changes to rural life. And what he's done with all three plays, really, is he's kind of established a very, very distinctive style, a very, very much a new style, well, certainly in, for today. Because all three of the plays, despite the fact the subjects are very different, they share a kind of warmth and empathy and a kind of gentle humour about them, which is really quite contrasting to a lot of more angry and cynical new writing. It's not an insult to say that it's, you know, he's become the kind of master of ordinariness, really. And I think, you know, he writes about people that we've probably known or met. And I think that he's kind of documenting real life in a way that nobody else is documenting real life. And I saw this the night after The Treatment, which is a kind of uber cool and uber cold kind of play. So the contrast couldn't have been greater, really. This is a two-hander. The main character, Carol, lives alone. We know that her husband has gone and her daughter has gone away. And she works in a local office, an electoral registration office, in fact. And she finds someone from her past sleeping rough, a chap called Eddie, who's a bit of a lost soul and a drifter, and then offers him a home. And she's clearly delighted to have someone else in the house, because she's also a bit of a lost soul as well. And they're reminiscing about the past. It's not, I don't think it's 100% clear what their relationship was, but there is a suggestion that their relationship was a partnership in some way. And Eddie has now, he's been abroad for 18 years, I think, and he's got his worldly goods in a few carrier bags. And the arrangement kind of suits them both, really. And it's got this gentle humour that is clearly part of his trademark. And I thought the character was very well drawn, particularly as it's only a 70-minute play. And Alice Hamilton, you know, she is clearly attuned to his style of writing, because the direction is sensitive to the material, I think. And we've got two very nice performances. Tessa Peake Jones, who we don't see often enough on stage, in my opinion, plays Carol, and then Andrew French performs the role of Eddie. And they're kind of dancing around each other a bit, really. And there's a lot of things that are unsaid. There's a lot of unsaid communication. And that kind of, those five kind of facial expressions and body language and all of that sort of says almost as much as the words they're saying, really. I don't think this has got the depth of the other two. I didn't think it was as good a play. And that could be partly because it is only 70 minutes. And it could also be partly because it's just two actors and therefore you don't have so much characterization. But I was still glad I went to see it. And again, it's in a small scale. I saw the other two plays in the Arcola studio. And this is, as you say, in the Bush studio, which is the first time I've been to the Bush studio. It's a nice new space, not unlike a lot of other spaces like Theatre 503 and the Finborough, and perhaps that kind of size, maybe a little bit bigger than the Finborough. So it was nice to see the new space. I thought it was the perfect play to put in the space. What will be very interesting now is that it's already been announced that he's putting in a play into the much bigger Bridge Theatre, Nick Hidner's new theatre on the South Bank near Tower Bridge, I think it is, next year. So he's already been programmed in for next year. So this will be interesting to see Barney Norris on a very different scale. So I enjoyed it, and I would recommend it to anyone. But it's a smallish piece, but it was a pleasant and enjoyable 70 minutes. What did you think, Tim?
Well, I certainly agree about the pleasantness. One of the things, though, that I found slightly uncomfortable, certainly towards the beginning, is I kept expecting everything to go horribly wrong. And I think that rather put me off, that sort of anticipation that something was going to go horribly wrong, because nothing really goes wrong in this relationship. You know, you do kind of expect, we've seen it before, somebody preying on an older woman, but it isn't that relationship at all. But I kept expecting something to go terribly wrong and something really dark to come out of this. And we don't get that. And so the appreciation of the play was slightly upset by my constant anticipation of something going nasty, because I'm very used to that in theatre. I mean, you would normally expect that sort of thing to happen, and it just didn't happen here. It's wonderfully subtly played. I mean, you can see that this couple have obviously had some kind of relationship in the past, but it's not really explicitly laid out exactly what their relationship was. He does seem to be a bit of a drifter who's been all around the world and not really made anything of his life, and to a certain extent doesn't want to. He doesn't want to be tied down in any way. But there is this portrait of loneliness you get from both of them, and you know, especially Tessa Peake Jones. This idea that, you know, she is rather isolated. She's okay, but not necessarily okay with being lonely, but she is okay in her life. She's not, it's not that she's going to be suffering from anything particularly wrong. I don't think it's quite as good as some of the other plays, and I think I agree that it's because it's only a two-hander and it's relatively short, and he isn't really going to any dark places in this play. He's holding back quite a lot. It would be rather more interesting to see him branch out into something. I mean, not necessarily something predictable, but something perhaps I don't really want to say a bit darker, because I was actually quite relieved after all the anticipation for it not to go dark and predictable. I was quite pleased about that. But I think you do need a little bit more grit in play to really make it a really great play. And I think it's a good play, and I think the performances are extremely good. And yes, like you, I like to see Chesapeake Jones in things. I think the first couple of things I saw her in were Pride and Prejudice in 1980, the good one, and a televised version of What the Butler Saw, which is rather interesting. So she's long been a very interesting actress for me, not just in comedy. There's one particular play, having just recently read some more Iris Murdoch, she did a version of Iris Murdoch's novel The Bell, which was on television at some stage in the 1980s with Ian Holm, and I'd love to see that. So, yes, I mean, she's a very interesting actress, I think. We're now going to talk about Romeo and Juliet at Shakespeare's Globe. This is the first large-scale main house production of Emma Rice's final season at the Globe, and only her second season. We spoke for probably rather too long about it on our Review of the Year show, so go back and listen to that. I stick by what I said at the time, which is the major reasons for her going are that she probably imposed a lot of costs on the theatre that the theatre didn't want to take, and ignored some of the things about the theatre that the theatre thinks are special. I don't like using the phrase shared lighting, because they almost certainly made that one up when they got rid of her, but the idea that you have to put up with the problems of the Globe. I mean, why bother having a wooden structure? Why bother having simulated daylight? And why bother having people talking over the sounds of helicopters and jumbo jets? It's because they're trying to recreate something that happened sort of 350, 400 years ago. So I think that, as I said at the time, they got Emma Rice in because they wanted somebody, they were going a little bit too heritagey, a little bit too traditional, so-called traditional practices, and they wanted somebody who would stir things up. They didn't expect her to basically say, well, I don't care about this, any of your silly ideas about shared lighting. I want everything well lit, and you're going to have to pay for it. And I have heard stories since then that basically they had to raid other departments at the Globe in order to pay for the lighting, and it was just too expensive. The Globe is a successful commercial theatre, but only a successful commercial theatre because they are very careful in their budgets, and I think she imposed costs on them that they weren't prepared to bear, and also the question of disrespecting the ethos of the theatre, which if you been going to the Globe as long as I have, with this is my 20th year, I think, I've been going to the Globe, you are very aware of the whole idea of trying to recreate as far as close as possible to old Shakespeare as we can today to an Elizabethan open-air theatre, and that just means you're simulating daylight, you're not trying to light the place, you just need enough light at night when that's where the audiences are, you just have enough light so that people can see onto the stage. That said, this production of Romeo and Juliet is directed by Daniel Kramer. He is currently the artistic director of the ENO, English National Opera, and it is designed by Sutra Gilmore with the original music composed by Ben DeVries. Daniel Kramer has done quite a bit of additional work in the theatre as well as opera. He worked on the headlong version of Angels in America, which we may have mentioned already. And, of course, in that was Kirsty Bushell, who stars here as Juliet. We also have Edward Hogg as Romeo, Ricky Champ as Tybalt, Tim Chipping as Paris, Blythe Duff as the nurse, Martina Laird as Lady Capulet, Golda Rochival as Mercutio, and Gareth Snook as Capulet. It is a really odd play. It is visually stunning, this particular production, and there are lots of interesting ideas in it, but I mean, it hasn't been particularly well reviewed, and I think the reason for this, certainly for me, was that none of what they were doing, although they were sort of changing the play and they had ideas about people, almost two scenes going on at the same time, which sort of interleave and interlock, it wasn't really speaking to the play. It really wasn't doing anything. It was as if the play, you know, the play was just going on and they didn't really care about it. And they weren't really, although they were doing the motions of the play, they weren't really interacting with the play. They weren't really bringing anything out of the play. I think some of the things, the ideas that Daniel Kramer brought to it were quite impressive. I mean, I quite liked the white face, which a lot of people have complained about, that everybody was more or less in white face, clown, almost clown makeup at times. The costumes are extraordinary. The ball where Romeo and Juliet meet is a sort of weird dance number. And I thought some of those things and some of the imagery and some of the way they did things were really quite impressive. And indeed, as darkness fell, the lighting rig that we have here is incredibly impressive. I mean, you can really see how well you can light something, and it could be seen almost an argument for having lighting. But what it did was that I was standing right next to the stage of this play, and in the early parts of the play where the lighting is not so important and, you know, it's nice and daylight outside, we were getting a lot of interaction from the actors. You know, they were talking to people, they were interacting with the people they could see. But the moment darkness fell, it meant that they could use the darkness in the play. They could do the thing that, the reason that theatre changed about 150 years ago, when they were finally able to turn off the lights and make everybody quiet in a theatre so you didn't have to shout over them. Suddenly you get that idea of everybody goes quiet when it gets dark and they concentrate on the thing that's lit. And that changes theatre radically. This is almost what you see, and this is, you know, the whole difference between the Globe as this experiment in Elizabethan theatre and modern theatre, the difference there is, just being able to turn off the lights and seeing how things go. But the moment they turn off the lights, and as impressive as they were, you know, in the audience, the moment they stop lighting the audience, and the moment we don't share with them, it was almost as if they retreated behind the footlights at this play, and it was quite shocking in that way, because you suddenly saw, well, you know, that's what the whole debate about shared lighting has all been about. And it's sort of illustrated for me why it doesn't work. And it doesn't work not because they can't make it work, because you can make it work at the Globe, but you just turn it into another open-air theatre. It's no longer the Globe. It, you know, the Globe does not have to be traditional costumes, but it has to be that kind of shared experience that we all share, and that you are aware of the audience and you're constantly trying to talk to them, and you're not relying on being able to speak out to the blackness as we have, you know, in all other modern Shakespeare and all other modern plays, indeed, where you don't really interact with the audience unless it's a bit of an experimental play. Well, this is what the Globe should be. It should be an experimental house. And they lose that here. But overall, as I said, it's the problem I had with this play was they were going through the motions of the play. They're not doing enough to really be the characters. It's not that anybody is, I didn't think anybody was particularly bad, but you could see that they could have been better. And you also needed one or two things explained. I mean, Kirsty Bushell has been acting for quite a long time. I mean, I think I've seen her in things for at least 15 years. So she's not the youngest actress ever to play Juliet, but it's not that, and that doesn't mean that her performance is any way bad, but I just wish I knew what the reason for it. It just seemed to be empty spectacle in this play, and not enough talking to the play and getting, you know, interacting with the play. They were just using it as an excuse. They were just going through the motions of the play, and I was rather angry about that. Now, I think you may have been even more angry about it, Gareth. What did you think?
I think that might be an understatement, really. Well, the first thing I have to say is I only saw the first half. I frankly just couldn't pull myself to walk back into the theatre. And I was by now fantasizing over a large glass of wine and some trashy television. So I can only comment on that. I can't comment on the change in lighting that you talk about in the second half. The second thing I want to say before I start is that even though when Emma Rice was appointed, I was a bit nervous that she might turn the Globe into knee-high London. She didn't have much of a track record with Shakespeare, although she had done a wonderful Cymbeline. I think she'd done it, certainly her company had done it. But I didn't join in the debate about her decision to leave, because I felt it was a debate that they should have had, perhaps they did have, when they appointed her. We would have expected the theatre to sort of lay out their strategy and mission. And we've all known since the beginning, and I've been going there for 20 years and have seen more than 100 things there. We all know that their mission is to seek to put on Shakespeare as it was put on in Shakespeare's day. And when the Globe first opened, and that was the most thrilling thing, because we'd never really experienced Shakespeare like that. And the most particular thing about it, the revelation, was the audience engagement. And the shape of the theatre and the size of the theatre meant that, you know, even with 1,500 people, the intimacy was extraordinary. So I would have expected the theatre to lay out their mission to Emma Rice. I would have also expected Emma Rice to lay out her vision for how she'd use the theatre. And then the result of that would have been that she was appointed to do what they mutually agreed to do, or that she wasn't appointed. So it seemed to me to have the debate a year on was a bit bizarre. The third thing to say is that I'm not a purist when it comes to Shakespeare at all. And I've seen lots and lots of radical interpretations. Very recently, things like Ivor Van Hove's Kings of War, where he's even sort of pushed plays together and done lots of filleting. The Almeida's recent Hamlet, so the National Theatre's recent Twelfth Night, and indeed at the Globe itself, I've seen lots of very radical Shakespeare. So it's not as if the Globe's never put on radical productions before. It has, lots of them. And the key feature about them all, or virtually them all, not quite them all, is that they've all served the play. And the fourth thing to say is that I don't have a downer on Daniel Kramer, my apologies, because I've enjoyed his work in the past, and I particularly enjoyed the Headlong Angels in America that you talked about, the first revival before this revival of that particular play. So my starting point with this was, oh good, I'm going to see Romeo and Juliet. I haven't seen that for a while. I'm going to one of my favourite theatres. And that's where it all went wrong for me, because the production doesn't serve the play. And therefore, it falls at the first hurdle. As you say, there's sort of, you know, there's all these black costumes and white masks. I'm not sure I'm particularly offended by that. There is a lot of music. I thought that the YMCA doing the Capulet's Masque, which is now a fancy dress party, with people dressed as Pluto and Wicked Witch and whatever, was just tacky. And I thought it lurched from gimmick to gimmick, really. I didn't feel the things they were doing were serving the play. I felt they thought, oh, let's do this, that'll be fun, that'll sort of shock everybody, that'll... Had it not been programmed before the departure was announced, I would have thought it was basically putting two fingers up to the Globe as an institution and saying, stuff you. But it was programmed before, so clearly, well, maybe it became more radical because of that, I don't know. But it was just a mess. And I think that it just didn't pause for breath, really. And I think the most important, the reason I say never serve the play is there was no real sense of feuding families here. There was no real sense of love at first sight. In fact, there wasn't an ounce of romance in it. And this is the greatest love story ever told. And it wasn't romantic. So that's why it doesn't serve Shakespeare's play. And that's why it isn't Shakespeare's play. As I titled the blog I wrote on it, this is Daniel Kramer's Romeo and Juliet in Emma Rice's Globe Theatre. I didn't feel, and it was the first time in 20 years, I didn't feel I was at Shakespeare's Globe, and I didn't feel I was seeing Shakespeare's play. And Daniel Kramer is now, as you say, the artistic director of the somewhat beleaguered ENO. And I gave up on the ENO and haven't been for a while for all sorts of reasons. But one of the primary reasons was that the directorial arrogance was such that they were totally disrespected Benjamin Britten with the production of A Midsummer Night's Dream. And then invited Terry Gilliam to direct there. And when he directed The Damnation of Faust, they billed it on posters and emails and everything else as Terry Gilliam's The Damnation of Faust. And you couldn't even find Berlioz's name, the man who composed the opera. So I'm afraid that kind of, I felt the same at the Globe. I thought, this isn't Shakespeare's play, this isn't Shakespeare's Globe. If you want to do all this stuff, we've got a company called the RSC who interpret Shakespeare for modern audiences. That wasn't what Shakespeare's Globe set out to do. And even though you know, they haven't stuck entirely to original practices. Otherwise, we'd just have men on the stage, for God's sake. So, you know, they haven't stuck to that entirely. They've experimented it and played with it and all of that. But the essence of the space and the essence of the mission of the Globe is to let us see what it was like by the man who wrote the plays in the period when he wrote them. And nobody else is doing that. Other people are doing modern interpretations very well. So I'm sorry, but this was completely misguided. And I suspect I won't be back in the Globe again until next year. And I've had wonderful, so many wonderful evenings and afternoons there. I can't begin to list them, but there you go. I left deeply saddened.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.